You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, for 14 years, painter Bob Ross taught Americans how to paint landscapes on the public television show The Joy of Painting. Now, fans are seeking wider recognition for the painter in the art world.
First, President Trump announced an agreement today with Mexico that would change key parts of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Here he is speaking from the Oval Office this morning.
This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs. It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill, and we are very, very excited about it.
The move marks a major step forward in negotiations, which have been rocky since they started between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada a year ago.
There are a lot of questions still, like whether Canada will agree to the changes and what businesses will make of the details.
Here to discuss all of this with us is Megan Casella, trade reporter for Politico. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the president said this morning that he's open to having a separate deal with Canada, and he's even calling this agreement the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement instead of NAFTA. Is it possible that this will become a bilateral deal between just the U.S. and Mexico?
It's hard to say at this point, but it appears that no. I think the legality of splitting this deal into two bilateral deals is pretty questionable, and that's because of some complicated trade statutes. But the way that they generally work is that, you know, Congress sort of signed off and had to be notified of what the administration was doing, and they agreed that the administration was modernizing NAFTA rather than negotiating new bilateral deals with each of the countries. So I think regardless of whether legally it actually comes down to being allowed or not, I think the administration is going to run into some pretty strong pushback, both from members of Congress, from the business community, from lobbyists, from all over the place, if they try to pursue two separate deals.
It does seem that Mexico and Canada have also been sending signals that they want to stand together. I think it seems like they see that as a more secure route to go in these renegotiations with the U.S.
Absolutely. I think each of those countries, you know, they've presented a pretty united front throughout this entire process since the negotiations started a little over a year ago now. And I think, you know, it's likely that the administration is really just posturing here. They're trying to use some pressure to say to Canada, the train is leaving with Mexico, whether you like it or not. So it's a question of whether you want to hop on and accept the changes that we've agreed to, or whether, you're going to sort of be left on the sidelines.
Given all of what we just mentioned, why has this phase of the talks been just between the U.S. and Mexico? Why hasn't Canada been part of it at this point?
So understandably, there were a number of issues that were more bilateral in nature between the U.S. and Mexico. Chief among them were these very complicated automotive rules governing how much of a car must be sourced from within North America in order to qualify for reduced duties under the agreement. And so, Canada agreed with the U.S. as a proposal, and they agreed with Mexico's proposal. And so on that issue, for example, they said, well, whatever you guys work out between the two of you, we'll be okay with. Part of that had to do with, for example, the wages that workers producing cars were making. Obviously, Mexico has lower wages, and so that was an issue for them, whereas with Canada, they said that was okay. So it's less that there was any ill will or bad blood between the U.S. and Canada, and more that they were just, you know, more complicated and a larger number of issues between the U.S. and Mexico that had to be dealt with first.
So these renegotiations have been going on, as we said, for about a year. Other than issues that you just mentioned, were there other bigger sticking points that needed to be ironed out?
There were. And the thing is that there still are. So the administration is heralding today's announcement as a major step forward as this comprehensive deal with Mexico. But they still left, you know, they've cleared a lot of hurdles, but they've still left some roadblocks on the table because they're trilateral in nature. So Mexico said, you know, we can't resolve all of these issues until Canada is back in the agreement. But, you know, one of the biggest things that remains that it appears that they've found a workaround for is that the U.S. wanted to implement what's called a sunset clause, meaning this deal would automatically terminate after 5 years. And Canada and Mexico both said, no way. You know, we're going through this very extensive renegotiation. We're not doing all of this work just to have it automatically terminate 5 years from now. So they're finding a way to work around that.
Megan Casella is with us right now. She's a reporter covering trade for Politico, and we're talking about what sounds like at least an intermediary deal between Mexico and the U.S. that would speed along the renegotiation of NAFTA. And what do we know exactly, or do we, Megan, about what came out of these negotiations between Mexico and the U.S.? What is settled?
So we know a little bit. So cars, I just mentioned a few minutes ago, they have implemented a new rule that at least 40% of every car must be produced by workers earning at least $16 an hour. So for unions and for labor advocates who have long, you know, railed against conditions in Mexico in particular, that's a big win for them. And the administration is trying to say this is great for labor groups who have long said that workers should be earning more. That's one. Something else, again, on cars is that it pretty drastically increases how much of a car must be sourced from within one of the NAFTA countries. And so that's supposed to help any cars being produced here be more competitive versus their German counterparts or their Japanese counterparts. It's supposed to help auto companies. And the administration also branded it as a win for business groups. But, you know, in that area, as well as others, business groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, and so forth, are already coming out, you know, with sort of tepid concerns and saying, we're still looking through the details, but we're worried that this actually isn't a step forward.
This is an interesting time for Mexico to be renegotiating NAFTA, because currently Enrique Peña Nieto is the president of Mexico, but Andrés Manuel López Obrador is the incoming president. And so this is kind of spanning that transition. How are the two administrations, the current and the future, dealing with this?
They're doing a pretty good job of working together and remaining on the same page. And actually, President Trump, in his remarks from the Oval Office today, he had Enrique Peña Nieto on the phone and praised him repeatedly, saying, you know, your transition team is working so well with your current administration. It's been seamless. You know, there was a little bit of a hiccup last week. We thought we were actually going to have a deal a few days ago, and something popped up last minute on energy, for example, that the current administration was open to opening up energy investment in Mexico, whereas the incoming administration was a little bit more concerned. So they had to get past that. But beyond that, they've done a pretty good job. And the only thing is just that the incoming administration is pressuring the current one to get it done as soon as possible, because they're saying, we don't really want to deal with this. We would love for you to finish this before we take office on December 1st.
As we said, this will have to be approved by Congress eventually. Are we getting any response from members of Congress from either side of the aisle with this announcement today?
They're pretty, measured in their responses today is what we've seen. And that's for both sides of the aisle. So we've seen lawmakers, you know, some Democrats sort of criticized the administration for the big to-do that they had today in terms of this announcement in the Oval Office, and saying, you know, one lawmaker called it ballyhooed, and saying that this was, you know, overblown, and this is only one step forward because we need Canada in the agreement before we can even move forward at all. And so I think that's going to be one of the main harping points for members of Congress, is that they're going to say, this is a trilateral deal. We only want it if it's a trilateral deal. Others are saying, you know, Ben Sasse, who's been very outspoken, a Republican senator, saying, you know, I'm worried that this is a step backwards. But again, they're also all saying, you know, they're adding sort of that conditional line that, you know, we're still looking through the details and we'll see what happens throughout the rest of this week.
Well, as you just said, Megan, Canada has to sign on to this or whatever form this takes. And the renegotiations have been going on for about a year. Is there an idea or a sense of how long that might take for Canada to go through it, decide what they can live with, and negotiate things that they don't think they can?
The hardest part about this is that the Trump administration is indicating they're going to notify Congress on Friday that they have a deal. And so the way that they've sort of framed it today is that we're going to notify Congress either way. Either we'll say that we have a three-way deal, or we'll say that we have a deal with Mexico and that we hope Canada joins in the future. And so that's sort of a legal thing that they have to do. And that sets off a clock. A 90-day clock before they can formally sign the agreement. But the administration said today that they're doing that on Friday, And, you know, that only gives Canada, what, 3-4 days to really agree to this. And so it's hard to see it happening that quickly, just given the extensive nature of this trade agreement, how complicated it is, how many chapters there are. But, you know, I've talked to some folks today who follow this super closely, and they say, I think it's going to happen, that Canada's been sort of at least tuned in, even when they weren't in the negotiating room the past several weeks. And so they're going to find a way to make this work.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for being with us and explaining this for us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Megan Casella, trade reporter at Politico. She was talking with us about a preliminary agreement between the U.S. and Mexico in NAFTA renegotiations.
Painter Bob Ross is best known for his time as the host of public television's The Joy of Painting in the 1980s. He encouraged viewers new to painting that mistakes were just happy accidents. Let's take a listen to a clip from the show.
Now then, let's decide. Maybe there's a happy tree, evergreen tree. He lives right there. Start with just touching the canvas. Use just the corner of the brush, just the corner. And begin pushing, making the bristles bend slightly downward. See there? Look at that. Isn't that a nice little tree? And he lives right here in this brush. All you have to do is sort of push him out.
While his television appearances made his face and name well known, Ross's paintings have never been featured in major museums and have sold at low prices or even not at all at auction. Now fans are seeking more respect in the art world for the painter.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch Bob Ross on TV when it originally aired? Do you watch it now since it's available on Netflix and YouTube? Do you think he deserves more recognition and respect in the art world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Joining us now is Kelly Crow. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering the art market. She recently wrote the piece called A Renaissance for Bob Ross. Fans want the Joy of Painting host to have a spot in art history. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Bob Ross has had, as you say, a renaissance of sorts, even though he's been around for a long time. He was on public television for a long time. Now he's on Netflix. And, you know, people who are fans for different reasons chimed in on Facebook. One person, Brandy, said it was like doing meditation with paint. And then there was the hair. So he was both known for a calm, gentle personality and, of course, aesthetically, his hair. In, you know, broader pop culture, where does he fall?
Well, I was old enough to actually watch him in real time, so that dates me for sure. But I feel like pop culture is sort of always this fluid thing, and we sort of, each new generation sort of gets to come in and determine sort of who's cool and who's not. And what's funny is that the younger generations of kids who are finding him by watching, let's say, the streaming service Twitch, right, they don't know, I mean, he doesn't fit within their pop culture in terms of how he dresses with his, you know, shirts unbuttoned down to his navel, and his big hair. I mean, that none of that is familiar, and that they've sort of embraced him as a cult, you know, icon figure. So I think, you know, pop culture is sort of whatever, you know, the next generation determines sort of who matters, and they're sort of, they love Bob. So, you know, he's getting another look, which is really fun.
Yeah, I also used to watch Bob Ross in the 90s. It was one of those things that my grandmother would let us watch. So he's been around, certainly in my life, for a fair amount of time, but it always felt like he was, and, you know, I work in public media, a public media person. So to see him kind of burst out into this new realm must be really interesting for people who do monitor this kind of thing to see who has this sort of longevity.
Well, it's funny, because my job, right, is to pay attention to sort of the zeitgeist of the art world, right? And who are they talking to? Who are they buying? Who are they collecting? I go to Sotheby's and Christie's and watch, you know, Da Vinci's sell for $450 million a piece. Like, you know, my world is usually pretty heady. And yet, you know, when I go home and I talk to my kids about what artists they know, I mean, I'm sort of embarrassed to say, even though I drag them to museums all over the place, right? But the handful of artists that they really have this unadulterated affection for is rather slim. And yet, like, my 16-year-old the other day mentions Bob Ross, and just out came this gush of, you know, affection. And I was like, how do you even know who Bob Ross is? Like, you were born, you know, in the 2000s. Like, how do you know this guy? And they all just know him. They were like, oh, well, he's on Twitch. I mean, to Bob Ross, you know, the headquarters, the sort of the company, right, that helps put out his paints and his painting kits, and to their credit, they really have latched on to some interest that came, you know, when Netflix approached them about putting, you know, versions of the show online, you know, when streaming services came, when they got approached by Comic-Con, South by Southwest, like groups that are not the traditional route to promoting an artist, right? Like, most artists want to get a nice dealer, get a good gallery, you know, make the right introduction to the right curator, get a show. I mean, there's sort of like a path to stardom through the art world. And yet Bob Ross just sort of forged his own path on public television. And what's fun is that sort of the renaissance of him is also forging its own path. I mean, he's sort of getting traction in venues way outside of the establishment, and it's kind of breathing some life. And the full circle, sort of the reason why I had to do this story, was that I was getting really tickled to see the artists sort of within the slipstream of contemporary art who do get shows at museums, who are collected by the right people, yada, yada, yada. Like, they were making pieces inspired by Bob. So I think there's a lovely full circle thing when they're starting to paint happy little trees, and then collectors and museums are buying those pictures. I think you have to count Bob Ross as a fun, at least an Americana figure of influence that I don't think we should ignore.
We're talking to Kelly Crowe right now. She's a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering the art market. And we're talking about a push to get Bob Ross, who you all might know from The Joy of Painting, into a headier world of, you know, art history. I want to take a quick call right now. We have Adam in Maryland, Wisconsin. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
And what did you want to say about this?
Oh, I was just going to say, I kind of wanted to weigh in on her previous point. She was talking about how Bob Ross has become kind of a staple in, you know, a culture that would normally not accept, you know, such a contemporary painter. But the thing is it's through memes. It was through the internet. Bob Ross, I mean, he was kind of a staple in the artistic, you know, public community for a long time, you know. But the thing that kind of brought new life to his art and his medium was more or less through memes, through the internet. It's quite funny if you do some research. I can't even tell you how many, you know, sort of comical strips I've seen, including Bob Ross. And I mean, I'm not sure if you know much about cinema, but even Deadpool, the latest installment of that comic book rendition, the comic book film, even it had like some a Bob Ross parody.
And Adam, thank you so much for that call. So he's talking about how the internet has sort of spurred, you know, Bob Ross along, and then we see it in other sort of pop culture moments like Deadpool. So when it comes down to this moment of how Bob Ross is pictured, do you think that it helps or hurts their case, his fans' case, when he does appear in, you know, memes and stuff like that?
Oh, well, you know, I spoke with people who knew him, who worked alongside him, who've known him, who knew him for decades before he died. He would have gotten the biggest kick out of it. I mean, really. I mean, I heard that at one point, I mean, in terms of licensing and branding, he was very savvy. He was okay to sort of, you know, he just wanted people to learn how to paint and to discover that that moment of putting the brush on canvas could be a fun one. It didn't have to be a terrifying one. You didn't have to go to art school. I mean, there's a really democratic approach that he had toward painting, and the whole gig was just to try to get people to try it, right? And so he didn't really care. I mean, if that meant that they bought a waffle maker or they bought, you know, his painting kits, then great. But if they didn't, that was also great. But someone who knew him told me that at one point he joked about making Bob Ross jeans, you know, Bob Ross branded jeans, which got vetoed, which is funny, but just goes to show he was a good sport about it. And also, you know, I mean, he didn't have great aspirations of being in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I mean, for him being on TV was was making it, right? So he, I think, was had a pretty good sense of humor about his own work. And he also really tried to create a look that was pretty timeless. I mean, we've talked a lot about the hair, which was funny because he initially, he doesn't actually have curly hair. He didn't actually have curly hair in real life. He dyed it because, or he permed it because he was crisscrossing the country on the road. So much teaching classes, doing demos in shopping malls and that sort of thing. And he just thought, oh, well, maybe if I perm it, I won't have to get it cut so often. And then the first time that he went on television, they kind of told him, well, you're kind of locked into this look now because we all think it's pretty hilarious. So he later kind of regretted perming his hair, but it was part of the look. And I actually think it's gone a long way. I mean, Andy Warhol used to wear a crazy, you know, a crazy wig. They called it a fright wig. And sort of artists sort of have their own shtick that I think sets them apart. He also tried very hard to be as timeless as he could, hair aside. You'll notice the background on his shows is just, you know, plain black. It's a really intimate sort of space. It's just sort of him and that easel and that black expanse. And he really tried, even with a denim shirt, you know, those things never really go out of style. So yeah, I think he had an inkling that the show could live on, or at least that he wanted it to live on sort of separate. So he didn't design sort of a hokey set that would really date it, you know, to the early 80s. And so I think for many, many reasons, it sort of has this timeless appeal that I think kids who are finding it through memes, through jokes about the hair, through Netflix, through Twitch, you know, however they're finding it through online reruns, what they're finding is that the way in which he talked about art and the respect and just the optimism, it's just so counter to, I think, a lot of, you know, the cynicism or the elitism that people feel, you know, when they step into a big, glamorous museum. Sometimes people feel like they have to whisper and they're in church and they don't know so much. And, you know, we don't need to make art that makes people feel stupid. It can challenge us for sure. And I think there is a really amazing conversation being had right now about contemporary art where we're, you know, with artists who are wrestling with really tough issues, social issues and political issues. But then there's also Timeless Bob, you know? I mean, we can't get rid of him either.
Well, Kelly, we have to leave it there for right now, but thank you so much for joining us. That was Kelly Crowe, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering the art market. She recently wrote a piece called A Renaissance for Bob Ross. Fans want the Joy of Painting host to have a spot in art history.
The push to legalize marijuana continues this fall with a number of cannabis-related initiatives on the November ballot.
4 states, Michigan, North Dakota, Missouri, and Utah, will be voting on legalization in some form. And earlier this year, Oklahoma passed a medical marijuana ballot initiative, and Vermont became the first state to legalize recreational marijuana through its state legislature. New Jersey could become the second as early as next month.
Here in Wisconsin, where pot is still illegal, Forest County became the 9th county to add a marijuana-related advisory referendum this fall. And in last week's Marquette University Law School poll, 61% of registered Wisconsin voters support legalizing marijuana and regulating it like alcohol.
Our next guest is here to talk about the shifting attitudes towards marijuana legalization or decriminalization and what it could mean for state and federal governments in the future. Sam Kamen is a professor of marijuana law and policy at the University of Denver. Sam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
So I just mentioned 4 states that are considering this. Other states have either legalized it or have tackled it in some way, shape, or form. And it looks like this November in 2018 could be one of the biggest years yet for cannabis reform. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, the states that you mentioned are not sort of the place that marijuana legalization got its start. It started with sort of very deep blue states on the West Coast. You know, Colorado, where I live and work, is a blue leading purple state, and you know it. Legalization and medical laws are really now branching from those origins more broadly throughout the country.
And is there any particular reason why we're seeing 2018 shape up to be a big year for marijuana reform?
Well, you know, I think if you look, it's sort of been year by year. We had Colorado and Washington went first. Oregon joined after that. California, the next election cycle. You know, it's been sort of slowly building across the country, and I think this is really a continuation of that. For a lot of people, it appeared that that progress was going to be derailed when President Trump was elected in the last election cycle, but you know, despite some real saber-rattling by his attorney general, we haven't seen a significant change in federal policy, and I think that activists are proceeding full speed ahead.
Do you think that perhaps the administration is seeing kind of the writing on the wall, that it doesn't want to challenge states' rights here, or is maybe something else at play?
It's really hard to know, and what we've seen from marijuana law reform is that it doesn't fall into neat left-right, blue-red categories. That is, that some people who are libertarian or have a states' rights outlook but might not be reliable Democratic voters have come along on this as well. In terms of what the, Trump administration is thinking about, that it's really hard to know. I mean, President Trump, when he was on the campaign trail, talked a lot about states' rights, and certainly states' rights has been a big issue for his attorney general. But, you know, Mr. Sessions also was quite vocal in saying that he thought that marijuana was just about as horrible a scourge as heroin is. So the fact that he hasn't acted on that, you know, just might be another tension point within the administration.
Now, just looking at the popularity of these laws, if we can call them popular right now, looking at Oklahoma, which has been, pretty reliably a red state. So, as you just mentioned, we can't throw, marijuana legalization into these like clear blue or red issues. But just taking Oklahoma as a case study almost, more than 1,600 people and businesses in the state applied for medical marijuana licenses on Saturday. And it was the first day that they were available. Is that at all surprising to you, or is this just another clear indication that this is the track that the United States is on?
You know, I think it's definitely the latter. When you see states like Oklahoma, you mentioned Missouri, North Dakota, we're leaving, as I said, that sort of reliably left coast, left leaning place where people are far more comfortable, or historically have been far more comfortable with marijuana use and legalization. And it really is becoming more of a national phenomenon.
We are talking to Sam Kamen right now. He is a professor of marijuana law and policy at the University of Denver. We are taking a look at the number of cannabis reform initiatives that are cropping up across both Wisconsin and in other states such as Oklahoma, as we just talked about, and looking to a more reliably blue state, Vermont, up until this year, initiatives for recreational pot were all done at the ballot box. They did something a little bit different this year. What's the significance of getting this reform done through the legislative process?
Well, I think, it's just sort of another Rubicon that's been crossed in the law reform movement. I think it has historically, I think the first eight states that legalized it through the initiative process. Seeing it done through the legislature indicates that politicians are now willing to put their name on the dotted line to stand up and be counted on marijuana law reform. And that has not historically been true. The governor of my state, straightforward Democrat, has been very ambivalent about marijuana law reform that's happened on his watch. A lot of politicians, I think there was only one state politician who endorsed Amendment 64 when we legalized here. So, it is not something that politicians have been willing to go out in front of the voters on. And now it seems that they're willing to at least follow.
Yeah, I don't want to sound cynical, but we are seeing some, younger politicians say, we want to see this legalized. We want it to be decriminalized, certainly. Is there a shifting political tide where politicians are saying, hey, I might be able to appeal to a broader base of voters if I take this stance?
Well, particularly if a politician wants to appeal to younger voters, marijuana legalization is enormously popular with millennial and Gen X voters. As with the marriage equality movement, we see real demographic and generational splits here. That is, the younger voters are far more willing and support both marriage equality and marijuana legalization by, you know, 2 or 3 to 1 in most cases.
And according to the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, or NORML is what it's called, only 19 states, including Wisconsin, prohibit both recreational and medicinal marijuana. Why haven't those states, you know, kind of jumped on the bandwagon here?
Well, you know, I think that medical marijuana certainly was the leading edge of marijuana law reform. It's in some ways been leapfrogged by recreational or adult use legalization. That is, people are saying, look, if we think this is a benign substance, if we think it should be used like alcohol, or regulated like alcohol, rather, a choice that adults can make, that in many cases is having more appeal than some of the medical laws. And, you know, I mean, there are still reasons that people oppose, and there are still organized opposition to the legalization of marijuana, whether it's from people that are concerned about public health, or people like Mr. Sessions that are concerned about public morality. This is not a this is not something about which there is an overwhelming national consensus, though. As the NORML data point out, it is now a majority of states. It is now a majority of people, maybe even a supermajority of people, who live in states where marijuana is legal for at least some purposes. And, you know, that number has been growing and growing pretty consistently since 1996.
We are talking to Sam Kamen right now. He is a professor of marijuana law and policy at the University of Denver. He's with us to talk about the push across Wisconsin and across the country to legalize and regulate marijuana.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support or oppose the legalization of marijuana, and why? If you're pro-pot, would you like to see full legalization or just for medicinal reasons? How do you feel about the growing number of states making some form of marijuana use legal? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Right now, we continue our discussion on the effort to legalize marijuana, either for recreational or medicinal use. 4 states will be voting this fall to allow it in some form, and 9 Wisconsin counties will have advisory referendum questions on the November ballot. Our guest right now is Sam Kamen. He's a professor of marijuana law and policy at the University of Denver.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Where do you come down on marijuana legalization? Do you support recreation? Recreational pot, medicinal pot, or should it all remain illegal? That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Now, Sam, really quickly, before we get to calls, right before we took a break, we talked about the difference in opinion on marijuana. Some people believe it leads to more crashes. Some people think it's totally fine. That's just one brief example. In states where we've had it, what have we seen with, drug abuse, and, you know, is some of that data being cherry-picked by some folks?
I would say that that evidence is being cherry-picked by people on both sides. So, you'll see reports that, there has been no change in youth or adult usage rates here in Colorado, and maybe that youth usage rates have even gone down, which I think is something that's proven true. But you'll also see, and there was just a study about this last week, increased cannabis use disorder. So people who are high all day, every day, that seems to be an increasing problem. And I think that both things can be true. That is that, I'm not one of these people that thinks that marijuana is a perfectly benign substance and that everyone should use it every day. I think that we have to regulate carefully. I think that regulation is as important as whether the status is fully legal or fully illegal. And I think that protecting vulnerable groups and consumers should be an important part of any initiative.
Now I want to go to our callers right now. We have Elizabeth in Ellison Bay. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. I am a CBD manufacturer and have been doing this for quite a while. I'm in Wisconsin, and when I look at rec and medical, but when I look at the different states, it looks to me like Washington may be doing the best job of legislating in a manner that protects the economic benefits and holds them within the state. Because, you know, some states, it's the darn sucking sound of money leaving the state, going to existing businesses that have been doing it for a while and know what they're doing. Whereas Washington has some pretty strict regulation that means that they want to maintain cottage business, which is awesome, and they want to make sure that everyone who's making money is really a resident. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on mechanisms for being supportive for each state economically and which state you think is the best model.
Yeah, Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that a number of states have tried that approach. I think Colorado was one of the first to limit investment to in-state entities. So, the idea originally was both because it's federally illegal and for the reasons the caller mentioned in terms of making sure that the revenues stay within the state. The idea was that only residents and residents of a couple of years could invest. One of the problems with that is that we see this race to the bottom that we do elsewhere, which is those places that accept outside investment get lots of it, and states that have limited themselves are left behind. The biggest example of that, I think, will be in Canada, which will legalize at the national level later this year. I think a lot of people are looking there with their investment dollars that may be very good. If you think that the right way for this industry to grow is slowly and through small businesses rather than conglomerated ones, the Washington approach, I think, makes a lot of sense.
So you just mentioned Canada, which they are considering a federal legalization of marijuana, but looking on our side of the border, it's still illegal federally. But in June, before heading to the G7 summit in Canada, President Trump was asked if he supports a bipartisan bill that would end the federal ban on marijuana. Here's what he had to say.
I really do. I support Senator Gardner. I know exactly what he's doing. We're looking at it, but I probably will end up supporting that, yes.
So he's referring to Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado, who introduced the bill along with Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren. What's the prognosis on that bipartisan bill?
I don't know whether that bill will pass, but we certainly have seen an accelerating pace at the federal level. It's also important to remember that if marijuana is rescheduled as opposed to removed entirely from the Controlled Substance Act, that will make it very difficult for the kinds of small businesses that your last caller mentioned to compete. That is, if marijuana is categorized alongside something like OxyContin or codeine, small producers will not be able to. We don't have small producers of opiates. It has to be done in a pharmaceutical way. There's heavy regulation, and that's the sort of thing that pharmaceutical companies will be doing rather than small entrepreneurs.
I want to go back to the calls right now. We have Jude in Iola. Hi, Jude.
Hi. I think that the legalization of medical marijuana is definitely something that we need to pass in the state of Wisconsin. We've already gone through all the problems with the opiates, and now there really is nothing available for people like me who suffer with pain every day. And I also think that the legalization of recreational marijuana would just sink all the people that are arrested for small amounts of marijuana. We could unload those people out of the prisons, and we wouldn't be paying all that tax money specifically just for that reason.
Thanks, Jude, for that call. So she had two interesting points. Let's go to the first one, which is something we hear a lot from marijuana advocates, which are for people with chronic pain, this is maybe, and I'm saying this in quotes, a more natural way to combat pain. How do you see that argument playing out, and has it been effective?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most compelling cases for, I think both of the reasons actually that the caller mentioned are compelling reasons in favor of legalizing marijuana, at least for medical patients. As an alternative to opiates, marijuana has lots to recommend it. That is, the treatment of long-term pain is one of the clinical uses that has proven, for which marijuana has proven most effective. It is certainly, I think even its fiercest opponents would say, considerably less addictive and subject to abuse than is than our opiates. On the other point, I think it's an important one, but I also think that we need to make some careful distinctions. That is, I believe the strongest argument for legalizing marijuana is to take it out of the criminal justice system. The caller mentioned people arrested for a small amount of marijuana. That makes no sense, and we've particularly seen the disparate racial impact of the enforcement of those laws. I think those values can also be oversold. So, the truth is that there aren't a lot of people in prisons and jails solely for possession of small amounts of marijuana. There are drug dealers, people who are illegally selling marijuana, who are there for those reasons. And just, a simple arrest can have a significant negative effect. But it's not as if our prison populations will go down significantly once we have legalized marijuana.
Now, Sam, we don't have a ton of time left, but I want to get one more caller on the air. We actually have Yuri Rashkin on the line, who is calling in to talk about being one of several counties that is considering this proposal. Hi, Yuri. What would you want to talk about?
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity. With the help from Wisconsin Justice Initiative, I proposed it in Rock County to have advisory referendum, and it passed 14-12, so now Rock County will have an advisory referendum. And it was a fascinating process where it was pretty clear that everyone has an opinion on this particular issue, as you can tell, because there's lots of phone calls, a lot of interest in this topic. It doesn't hurt to have a few numbers so we can kind of buttress our points, but in the end, everybody has an opinion. So my quick question is, Professor, what is people are asking me a lot of, well, let's say advisory referendum passes, then what? And I look at it from there's going to be local consequences, there's going to be state lawmakers that are going to be more supportive, but there's going to be local municipalities that are likely to propose decriminalization of marijuana or cannabis should the advisory referendum pass. But other national examples, I understand Massachusetts was successful in legalizing cannabis through these advisory referendums. What is your experience or feedback there?
Thank you for the question. I'm not as familiar with the advisory referenda. It's not something we've done here in Colorado, but I think the idea of local control is a really important one. So built into Amendment 64 here in Colorado was the idea that if a municipality doesn't want marijuana businesses located there, it has both time, place, and manner restriction power over those businesses, but it can also ban them entirely. So while marijuana is legal throughout our state, it's not true that in every city and county it can be purchased. That is, that's a local decision. And I think, that is one of the parts that makes it attractive. I think people can say in a particular community, this is something that should be available, but we're not sure that we want it in our city. So while the localities can't prevent the possession, they can say, well, our citizens may have to travel elsewhere to get it.
In sort of the last minute that we have here, Sam, looking at these, the referendum nationwide, how do you see this going in November?
Well, I'm not in the prognostication business, and certainly the last election made me resolve not to weigh in too heavily on those things.
Sure,
The momentum is certainly, notwithstanding the Trump election, the momentum is certainly in the direction of reform, and whether that means that two or three or four of these will pass. You mentioned a 61% approval rating.
And Sam, we'll have to leave it there. Sam Kamen is a professor of marijuana law and policy at the University of Denver.
And you can continue the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us if you support legalization of marijuana or not and why.